And here on KBRB, we are joined on the phone lines by 43rd District State Senator Colonel Tom Brewer. Joins us as he does from time to time. And, well, typically when we visit, it's about happenings in the legislature, but not really the case today. So I know at the time we last visited, you were preparing to head overseas and assist Ukraine's efforts against Russia. Just wanted to touch base on how that trip went and where were some of the areas where you provided your knowledge and support.
Well, it was one of those trips that absolutely went completely different than planned. You spend months thinking that you can kind of have a foolproof plan that can't go wrong, and pretty much from the time I hit the ground over there, everything that I'd planned went awry, to include the fact that my bags didn't arrive. Spent months putting together everything you could ever want, to include the helmet and body armor and all the accessories, and I was notified one day before I came back home after a month and a half that my bags had arrived finally in Krakow, Poland. And so I was able to literally go through the airport, pick up my bags, re-tag them, and stick them back on the belt and send them home. So you had to go into the Ukraine with none of your gear, not even a change of socks or underwear. So spent a little bit of time boosting the economy of Lviv, Ukraine, because that was the first stop we had, and I was able to find clothes eventually at the bazaars there, but it was kind of different in the sense that some of the equipment that was supposed to be fielded didn't make it, and so we shifted gears. The mayor of Lviv, he took us on a tour of their military hospital. We had a chance to talk to some of the wounded soldiers there, and then we actually went to a funeral of a couple of soldiers from Lviv that had been killed. And it was impressive to see how they stood downtown of 2 million people to honor these soldiers. And then it was kind of a humanitarian support mission we did from there in Chernobyl, and that was just loading a lot of boxes of stuff and getting it prepped to go to different places in the country. And then we went into Kiev, which part of that in Kiev was to meet with folks at the embassy, kind of go over the plan. And it turned out that our embassy there is abandoned and there wasn't anybody there. Can't exactly tell you why, but it did make for some challenges, because part of that briefing would be an intel update on where things are, the do's and the don'ts and all that. But evidently, our State Department made a decision that it was too risky to be in the Ukraine, and so they are not in the Ukraine. We went north of Kiev and toured an area by Bakhiva where the Russians had been when they invaded on 24 February, and that was a bit of an eye-opener. They leveled some towns and killed a lot of people, and, I mean, it was just a pretty sad tour to go up and see that and what all they had done. We had some time to do some tours, some of the ag facilities there, farms, did a dairy farm, and one that was pretty much just all grain. The primary was wheat and sunflowers. Sunflowers are a big crop over there. And surprisingly, think of Iowa, the size of Texas, and that's what you have in the Ukraine. It's literally from corner to corner, top to bottom, are farm fields as far as you can see. And they were booming with crops. As we went to the east, many of those crops were unharvestable because of the war, and many of them were being burned. The Russians would fire artillery, and the artillery would start fires, and of course, if it's a wheat field ready to go, you know, it goes up pretty fast. So it's kind of sad in that way to see so much of their work destroyed. But it's the nature of the beast. You know, it's truly a nation at war. Everywhere you go on the streets, everywhere you go on the highways, you're seeing military vehicles as you get closer to the front. You know, there's bombs landing, rockets going by, and just stuff happening constantly. And for about a month of our time over there, we pretty much were stuff was landing, fortunately not real close to us except for a few days. But it was definitely one of those experiences where, after being in Iraq and Afghanistan, we never had the volume of fire, the I guess, sheer size of the explosions. They're going through a lot of just really hard times over in Ukraine right now because the Russians are just bringing hell down on them. But their spirits are good, and then they're doing a good job of fighting the Russians with a lot of leftover Soviet stuff. They're gradually getting in some of our U.S. stuff, and that's making a huge difference. The HIMARS has changed the whole complexion of the war, and they're taking out deep targets with the HIMARS, ammunition dumps, command headquarters, things like that. So there's some good news stories in there, but the month of May and June was really hard on the Ukrainians. They lost a lot of folks. The Russians were losing a lot, too, but they have more to lose. So it was just kind of hop back and forth between doing the humanitarian mission and touring some of their facilities over there, everything from hospitals to some of their ag ports where they were bringing grain to then have it transported. They're limited now because they've lost all their ports except Odessa. And Odessa, they had an agreement 2 days ago on bringing wheat out through there, and then literally minutes after they signed the agreements, the Russians hit it with cruise missiles and took out the port. So probably not bringing a lot of wheat out of Ukraine this year, and it's too bad. They provide a good share of the wheat for Africa and for Central Asia.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack, and certainly you didn't have much to unpack from what it sounds like, and just, you know, I'm sure a much different experience logistically than when you were with the U.S. military, who obviously has the track record of the good logistical support for its military. So, you know, you've got a long career in the military. I was just going to get your observations based on what you saw, and I know that's a little bit limited based on your activities there, but you know, assess for us Ukraine's ability to continue to defend itself against this much larger invading military?
Yeah, that's a great question. First off, understand that every male between the age of 18 and 60 are mandatorily in service. That may not mean you're in uniform. If you're a farmer, obviously you're going to keep on farming. In many cases, if you don't wish to be a actual participant as a soldier, you can work in hospitals, but no one is allowed to leave the country between those ages if you're a male. And when I went to the front, I was surprised to see in the trenches, in the fighting positions, a lot of the soldiers are between the ages of 40 and 60. And that was kind of a shocker for me, but everybody's pitching in to win this war. I guess I was in Afghanistan in my 40s and 50s, so, I mean, there's none that, but, you know, I was a colonel, and these guys are privates or corporals that are out in the trenches there. But to the person, as I talked to him and said, you know, you're going against an army numerically about three times the size of yours, vastly superior equipment in most cases. That's changing as the new weapon systems are coming in from the West. You know, what's your feeling? And they said, listen, we have lived under the Russian thumb before, and we won't do it again. We will die, and if that's what we need to do, then so be it, but we are not going to do it, and Russia will not win this war. I believe wholeheartedly that that's the way it's going to be, that they will either kill them in massive numbers or they're going to win the war. But I see an energy and a motivation with Ukrainians you didn't see with the Russian soldiers. You know, there was a lot of the Russian soldiers that they had captive that we saw over there who admitted that they had been brought from Vladivostok, that they're just running out of people. They're in the prisons offering amnesty to folks to come and fight. They're taking individuals who were in the Donbass, who would live there when they took over, and forcing them into the Russian army, so they're Ukrainian, to fight against the Ukrainians, and they put them in the front, and then they have more, I guess what you call seasoned Russian troops behind them, and if they turn to run or they try to give up, they're shot. So their situation is to be shot by the Ukrainians or be shot by the Russians, and you know that's not a professional army when you're forced into those kind of situations, and that's where the Russians are. I think the war will probably go into the fall as more of these Western weapon systems hit. There will be a point, I think, the Russians will have been bled so hard, because if you look numerically, They're near 40,000 killed and over 100,000 wounded. You cannot, in 4 months, going in the fifth month, sustain those kind of casualties and then continue to do that. There's a point your system will collapse as far as the military, because you're going to run out of people unless they go to a full draft conscription, and right now they've already done a partial one. So I think that the Ukrainians will, at points, the rub will come, because I can see some of the NATO countries saying, okay, let's just call it even Steven. We'll just stop everything where it's at, and everybody go to their corners and behave. Ukrainians aren't going to do that. They're going to take back the Donbass, and they're going to take back Crimea, and that's going to cause a big fight. But I think there'll be a point where they're going to feel empowered and emboldened as they get better systems, and will push the Russians out. The question is, will the Russians go to a thermal tactical nuke? And tactical nuke being a small one that they can shoot that may take out, you know, 10, 12 square miles, but not be one that would be considered a strategic weapon.
Well, it's, you keep continuing to see, you wonder how a military, even as large as Russia's, can sustain, as you talked about, that kind of effort with their mounting losses. You know, we read and hear, and you talked about some of these advanced weapon systems that are being supplied to the Ukrainian military from several countries, and you know, sometimes each of those systems are unique. How difficult is it for their military to be trained to use those advanced systems and maximize their effectiveness in the field when they do arrive?
Well, another great question. What they're doing right now is they're shuttling out Ukrainian soldiers in the night into Poland, into Germany, into the UK, and they're being trained up on the weapon systems and firing the weapon systems there, getting up to speed as best they can in a pretty condensed period of time. Then they are brought back to the Polish border. They're married up with their equipment. It crosses from Poland into the Ukraine. That starts a marathon trip across the Ukraine, because where you cross the Polish border to where the battle is going in the Donbass is about 700 miles. Well, you've got to be careful, because if you're out during the day and the drones can see you, the drones can kill you. And then Russia has drones, too. They don't have near as many drones as the Ukrainians do. The Ukrainians are using a lot of commercial drones, and it's been very effective for them. But the Russians have a lot of cruise missiles. They're very accurate. They can hit things on the move. So they move during the night, finding trees to park in the day, and then at night they move again. So they push as hard, as fast as they can during the hours of darkness. And that's how they hopscotch across the country to get into position. But some of the systems that are high-priority targets, the HIMARS, which are, think of giant trucks, almost like a semi-truck with a box on the back that elevates, turns, and that box has six missiles in it. Those six missiles can be targeted to shoot a 55-gallon can 50, 60 miles away. So, I mean, it's a very nice system. Once you're trained up on it, fortunately, it doesn't require a lot of training. I mean, you can do it in a matter of a couple of weeks. You can have them ready to go, and they have. There's 12 systems on the ground. We watch one fire, and it's quick. And once it fires, it brings that launcher unit down, and it gets out of there as quick as it can, because Russians have a target acquisition system that will find it, fix it, and kill it if they don't.
Well, you know, that's, like I said, hearing that from somebody who's seen it firsthand, you know, it's certainly something we don't get to hear about a lot. You know, in your assessment, what additional assistance is Ukraine going to need from the U.S. and other allies to successfully, you know, repel the Russians to the point that forces some kind of ceasefire agreement?
I think that controlling the air is going to be critical, and where we probably have dropped the ball is we should have given them a aircraft that would have given the ability to control the airspace above the Ukraine. That may have been the F-16, possibly the A-10. The problem is we slow rolled them. I believe the current administration felt that they were going to lose the war in a matter of days. That's why they offered to fly Lewinsky out early on, but the president said, no, don't send me a plane unless you're sending me a plane load of ammo. And that was the right answer. Had he left, I think there's a pretty good chance the system may have collapsed. But they think the world of him, and he is a good president. He's done a good job. Since the war started, he is really, he has nightly, I don't know, fireside chats. You turn on the TV and he's there and he's talking about the successes and what needs to be done next. Some of that's talking about hospitals and what they need to do to help in different hospitals. It might be talking about how they need to get more crops to different places so they can be hauled by rail into Europe because they can't move it by ship out to the Black Sea. But, you know, he is really, for the reputation he has as an actor or a comedian, whatever it was, you wouldn't know that now because he's all business. And that's what's really unified that country is that the president and the people have kind of banded together, and there's nowhere you go that there isn't Ukrainian flags, the blue and white flag everywhere. I mean, nationalism and pride in our country is something that is alive and well, and their nationalism goes clear back to the 1800s. They just didn't survive the Bolshevik Revolution, and of course, the Second World War is a little hard on them since they're used as cannon fodder by the Russians. So they're ready to keep the freedom that they had after the wall came down and willing to die for it. And I think as long as we continue to provide them the weapons system, they'll do the fighting. And that's the key, is let's not have Americans over there fighting the war that they're willing to fight if they just have the tools. Where the issue is going to be is reconstruction once this war does end, because a lot of their hospitals have been hammered really hard. A lot of their schools and universities have been hammered. Why the Russians are targeting them, anybody's guess on that. But there is going to be a lot of things that need to happen in order for that country to come back alive. But fortunately, the ag side of it looks pretty good, other than crops being burned. Overall, I was really impressed with how well the country is managed on its ag side. But if their crops are forced to not have a route out of the country and they go, you know, go to waste, then that's going to be a sad story. That's a critical area on the ag side, and there are some possible ways. The problem, the roads are plugged up right now, moving equipment, men in and refugees out. So the rail system becomes how they have to get it out, what they can. Unfortunately, the Russians are targeting that rail system too. So, you know, it's just really kind of a sad story on how much destruction has been done to a country who didn't do anything. I mean, it was when we talked to some elderly people that were in a basement on the border and asked them, you know, what caused this to happen, you know, they said, we don't know. You know, we were enjoying retirement, playing with the grandkids and just living life, and then on 24 February, our world got turned upside down, and Russian troops end up on our doorstep. And this is the life we have now. We live in a basement, and we depend on you guys bringing us boxes of food, or we starve to death.
Yeah, pretty sobering to see that daily life can be turned that quickly upside down. But I appreciate your update there. You know, it's I know a perspective that people around here, you know, would know and trust, that somebody that they know has been there and can give us some firsthand information. Wanted to just touch quickly back here at home. So I know you haven't had a lot of chance to kind of to get back and get caught up with things, but with the Supreme Court overturning, you know, the Roe versus Wade decision, wondering if you've heard anything or if you anticipate the legislature being called into special session this fall by the governor to potentially pass legislation regarding abortion.
Well, I was told to cut the trip short to the Ukraine to get back for that special session. And so I was a little surprised today when I had a conversation and said, all right, what's the story? And they said, well, here's the deal. We had the trigger bill, which was an abortion bill that was up during session. And that was kind of a bill that was designed so that if Roe versus Wade was to go by the wayside, there would be something that would come into place to kind of have some type of a way ahead. Well, what happened was that bill failed 31, needed 33. Talking to them today, it sounded like they may not have that 31, maybe down to 30. there's no reason to bring all the people to Lincoln, to bring all the special staff in, the costs, and everything else, if there's no way to get to 33. So I think unless there are some folks that are asked directly, you know, how they're gonna weigh in on this, that change their mind, I don't see a special session, because I think it'd just be a waste of time. It'd be a lot of fighting, and you've seen what happens with the legislature. They can go on with filibustering anything they want, and if you have no way to break the filibuster, it really will be a waste of time. So I, at this point, I'm not anticipating one. The other thing is that as we get any later in the year, we're going to be running up against the elections in November, and the ability for everyone to go and run for re-election that's up for re-election. So there's a lot of things working against them, and I, you know, I think my gut right now says that there won't be a special session.
Well, appreciate that information. Glad you were able to make it home safe, although sure it didn't make life easy to pack all that and not have it show up with you in country, but appreciate your service over there and helping out a worthy cause for a fellow democracy. So thanks for providing us with that update, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
All right. Thanks, Rick.